Okay. So here we are, reading what is a pretty challenging set of materials, it seems to me, from Knowledge of Time and Space. I will remind you, or I'm not sure if I've told you this story, but I'm going to tell you a story about how Knowledge of Time and Space came to be. When I was working on Love of Knowledge, Rinpoche had given me a whole lot of material, and there was some of it where I said to him, I don't understand this, Rinpoche. I just can't understand this. And he said, well, put it aside. Don't worry about the parts you can't understand. Just work with the parts that you feel you can work with. And so I did, and that became Love of Knowledge. And then later, we went back to the parts that I felt I couldn't understand, and that became Knowledge of Time and Space. It's challenging material. Now, Rinpoche, you know, we then worked some more with that material, and Rinpoche added material and so on. So it's not just, I don't want to say that Knowledge of Time and Space is incomprehensible to me or to anybody else, but it's challenging. It's a lot of it. Some of it is just, well, it's really a wonderful book. But when you work with the material, I think you have to really work hard. You have to kind of challenge yourself to say, well, how can I make this meaningful? How can I engage it? And it's worth it. You know, the payoff is that you really understand some wonderful material. So that's all by way of introduction. We're working with this series of chapters on the Logos, and we've prepared ourselves by working on material on the Logos and the readout. That's what we focused on last week. We've prepared ourselves pretty well for that, I think. So the real challenge, it seems to me, with respect to the material we're looking with today is how do we keep it from being abstract? And the reason that it's abstract is interesting in itself. At least, you know, my tendency is to say, well, gee, that sounds really interesting, but also kind of remote. That's what I mean by abstract. And I think the reason that it seems abstract is that that's our understanding of knowledge. So it's actually an example of the Logos in action. We say that the way to understand things is to have kind of a conceptual grasp of them. And so then when we approach knowledge, we approach it in a conceptual way. And so that is the way we understand what it means to develop knowledge. But it's not what this reading means by how to understand knowledge. So the question is, how do we bridge the two, and how do we do it in a way that's alive? Now, what I want to do, and I didn't mention this in the orientation, but I'd like to start, I'll say a couple of things more, but I'd like to start with some practice and do the practice that was assigned for this week and start the phone call that way and give ourselves about 5 minutes and then use that as a way into the rest of the material. And so again, the question becomes, how can we do this practice? It was exercise 48 in Love of Knowledge. How can we do it and bring it alive? And of course, I'm very interested in hearing what your experience has been during the week. But we'll do it now and then see where that leads. I have a specific way that I want to get into the practice, something we can focus on. So first of all, exercise 48 refers back to exercise 47, and we'll look at them together. And I won't look at them we won't go through the whole description. There's two things I want to focus on, really, in two short statements in these two exercises. So exercise 48 at the end of the exercise talks about, well, so the exercise talks about putting time and space and knowledge at the center of experience. And then it talks about that as you know, it suggests some of the ways in which that's going to change experience. But at the very end, it says, continued practice of this exercise can introduce a non-ordinary way of being in which knowledge could be said to choose itself. So that notion that knowledge chooses itself, and the parallel notion, which we'll look at more in a moment, that knowledge is not what the knower knows. That's a theme that we've talked about many times, and I think it's something that I like to say is really fundamental to the whole TSK vision, that knowledge is not what the knower knows, and that we trick ourselves and cheat ourselves when we reduce knowledge to being what the knower knows. So here it's saying that knowledge can be said, sorry, I didn't get the language exactly right again, knowledge chooses itself. It does that without having to rely on the self as knower. Now, when we look back at exercise 47, which asks you to reflect on your life as an expression of the interplay of time and space and knowledge, and specifically says the self is not at the center, right? It says usually the self thinks of itself as the actor, but in this exercise, the idea is to make space, time, and knowledge the actors, and the self and objects are like props in the play. I see that Ron is asking about the audio. Does it seem to be working all right for other people? Anybody have a problem?
I get moments, short moments of distortion, but mostly it's okay.
Okay, let me actually turn down the sound a little bit, because distortion could be sometimes come from that. So Kathleen says it sounds fine to her. So Ron, maybe you should turn down the sound, or I don't know, I'm just guessing. Okay, so going back to the practice, time, space, and knowledge are the actors in this play, and the subject and the object are like props that the actors use. So that's really a kind of a very wonderful image for this shift, so that knowledge is not what the knower knows. The knower is, you know, it's a little bit like saying, if you've got a telephone, if I'm speaking through a telephone, as I am, then you say, well, it's not the telephone that knows. It's not the telephone that's speaking, even. I'm the one that's speaking. So in this case, we're saying it's not the self that knows. The self is just a prop. The self just makes it possible for knowledge to manifest. And objects likewise are just a prop. And that relationship between subject and object is something that we're going to look at later. But right now I'm just setting up the exercise. So the exercise has to do with this idea, and I want to focus on the specific, again, the last sentence in the exercise, where he says not only can you think of subjects and objects as being like props, but he says subject and objects are symbols of the interplay of space, time, and knowledge, right? And thus, symbols of each other. I think that's the description that is maybe where I think it might be helpful for us to look. And I want to suggest something specific. I'm going to have you do an exercise, and you can move away from this as you start to do the exercise. But as a starting point anyway, rather than our usual approach to doing an exercise, which I think for most people is you kind of settle back and either you close your eyes or you look around you and you try to get a sense of the whole world, the whole reality that you're in, and then you apply the exercise to that circumstance. That's a good way of proceeding, but one of the problems with it is it makes us very dependent on sight. You know, we look around, we see the world, and then maybe we try to feel our way into it, which is good. So instead of focusing on sight, I'm going to suggest that you focus on touch. So when you do this practice, and the specific practice here is this sense that subjects and objects are symbols of each other, and at the same time as they're symbols of the interplay between time and space and knowledge. When you do that, start by holding something in your hand. Anything. And ask that question. In what sense can you say that subject and object are symbols of each other? Or maybe the word symbol, you could experiment with some other word, but let's stay with that. Subject and object are symbols of each other at the same time as they're symbols of the interplay among time and space and knowledge. So that's the practice. Let's do that for several minutes, okay? And then we'll see how people engage it. Okay, let's practice. Okay. Let's come back. Let's do a little variation on that exercise just for a minute now, okay? And that is same practice, subject and object as symbols of each other, or sort of, you might say, interpenetrating each other. Do that same practice while you're performing an action. So there's going to be some objective part of the practice, of the action, you know, anything, you know, scratching your hand, anything at all. But the subject and the object aspects of doing the action, we'll just do that for a minute. Okay? Okay, so here's an opportunity for you to say something about what came up there, or questions you have, or maybe reflecting on the larger issue of abstraction that I've brought up. Okay, Caroline has a comment here in her question. She says, "I'm not clear on the use of the word symbol in this context. I can see how pen and hand are manifestations of TSK, but not symbols. I can sense their complete interdependence, but don't know if this is the same as being a symbolic interplay of time, space, and knowledge." Right. So it's a good question. Let me say one thing. You say pen and hand. It looks as though you're saying those are examples of subject and object, but you know, I'm not sure I'd say that the hand is an example of the subject, except that we're very identified with it. You know, it's very much mine. So I'm not sure if that's what you had in mind, but I just wanted to call attention to that. So the word symbol, to come back to that, yeah, I'm not sure either. You noticed that I was a little uncomfortable with it. I was saying, well, you could use a different word, or when we did the second part, I suggested maybe talking about interpenetration or interaction between subject and object. So I'm not sure I have a good answer for that. One aspect perhaps is to say that the word symbol takes us out of the commitment to the kind of objective substance of something. You know, where we say, this is the subject and this is the object. Symbols are more open and fluid. So I'm going to leave it at that. I don't feel completely satisfied with that, but it's a good question. I don't have any more to say about it. Okay, David, reporting on the exercise, says, "I became aware of the physical objects, my hand, my body-mind." Okay, so again, we have this question. Is the hand, you know, is that a place where subject and object intersect? Or is there something that's subjective about the hand? Or could you do both at once? I mean, could you, I was actually thinking about this with the breath. You know, you can, if you're aware of the breath in a kind of meditative way, sometimes we approach that as saying, beware of the breath, which turns the breath into an object. But you can also be aware of the breath in a more subject-centered way, in which there's the breathing itself carries the awareness, which is the main distinguishing feature of the subject. So, again, I'm just raising that question for you to look at. So I became aware of the physical objects, my hand, my body-mind, and my iPhone in my hand. But I also was aware of my ideas of identification of both subject and object. Okay, the symbols were spacious. So David doesn't seem to have any trouble with symbols. Maybe you can suggest something about how that works for you, how you understand that. The symbols were spacious, accompanying a more substantial felt substance of both. So that's interesting. So the subject feels more substantial and the object seems more substantial, and that goes along with a kind of spacious quality, even though substance, we would normally distinguish that from space. But so you find the two kind of support each other. Okay, then I tried to turn on the phone, exercising control, using intent and an active will. So yeah, you know, that actually, I don't know if you are referring to the second little addition to the exercise that I suggested, but it does seem to me there'd be a lot of ways to explore the relationship between subject and object. And really, that's one of the fundamental themes in the reading that we had today. And you might want to think about it in terms of subject-object reversal or object and its globe. You know, those are two exercises that everybody is probably pretty familiar with. This is not subject-object reversal. In a certain sense, it's more subtle because it's saying that the subject is the object. It doesn't quite say that. It says the one is, you know, they're symbols of each other. But I'm going to simplify a little. You say you don't need to reverse anything because the subject already is the object and the object already is the subject. And how does that work? And so there are different ways to explore that. And one way, as David suggests here, is by doing something. And that was kind of what I suggested also. What happens then? What's the relationship between the subject and the object? Okay. Ron says, I seem to imagine watching the subject-object interplay from the point of view of a mirror reflecting their movements. Well, that's an interesting way to approach the exercise. I think that sounds promising. I don't know if you found it promising or interesting to do. Maybe you could say more about that. But there is a sense, you know, it's the non-identification with the subject. That's really very important in this. The knowledge, you know, what did it say? Knowledge is its own, I forget the language now. The easier way for me to say it is just knowledge knows itself. But in any event, you know, it is kind of a question of taking a stance, not a position. We have to be careful. We're not interested in positions. But somehow disengaging from being here or being there and being from and being to, and that kind of mirror-like awareness, to use a Buddhist term, might be a way to do that. Okay, Klaus says the subject and object seemed to reflect a knowing quality to each other. Well, that seems very, very much at the heart, I think, of what this exercise is about. So that's the right way to explore it. And Bruce says, in reflecting on subject and object as symbol, I may have looked more at them as signs. So the relation between symbol and sign, that's a whole topic, but we won't go into that. Maybe Bruce will clarify it. I may have looked more at them as signs because I encountered each as what the other points to or is for. Here, hand as subject, okay, that question again, is for all things graspable and touchable, and in fact could be seen as having evolved as a mode of sensitivity and contact, not as an object, in relation to objects. And see, okay, I guess I'll keep reading. There's quite a bit here, but I'll finish it. In seeing subject and object as symbols for the interplay of TSK, this became especially clear when I introduced action. Okay, subject and object became incomplete in relation to the dynamic interaction. Subject and object became incomplete in relation to the dynamic interaction of time-space knowledge in the opening and closing of the glasses case I held in my hand. Yeah, that's I think that helps clarify why for me, it helps clarify why I thought it would be interesting to apply this in the case of action. You know, when we're acting, we're kind of, as David said, we're inserting our will into the world. You know, we're acting on something. And so there's kind of a natural place for merger there. So that's really good to explore. I just wanted to, what you write here reminds me of something that I've always found an interesting or useful way to think about things. I don't know if he was a scientist or not, but there is a fellow who's quoted in the literature quite a bit of unconsciousness named J.J. Gibson. And Gibson said that the thing about objects, the way to understand objects, is that they afford us certain opportunities or possibilities. It's kind of a technical way of using the word afford in English, and so it might not be clear for people who are not native English speakers, but what he was saying was they offer us an opportunity. That's how we use that phrase. They afford us a certain opportunity. So a cup, let's say, with a handle has an affordance. That's how he describes it. It affords us the opportunity to pick it up or affords us the opportunity to pour something into it. And again, when you see objects in that way, it's nice because it's suggesting that the subject and the object together are what make up the object. And I'd have to think it through a little more, but the object and the subject together are also what make up the subject. I suppose because the subject is always has its projects, you know, like drinking a cup of tea. So the subject is already out there with the teacup and the tea and so on. So these are some ways of starting to think about this. And I think that's what we want now, is just ways of starting to think about it. Because, as I said, we'd like to keep this immediate, not abstract. And I think everybody's been pointing to some very nice ways of doing that. So let's see. Michael says, I noticed that the objective realm defines what I long for, elements in short supply. Yeah, if you think in terms of affordances, you'd say, you know, the objective world affords me the opportunity to gratify my desires or my longing. You know, that's sort of how we approach it. In the Buddhist tradition, they say that we, meaning regular human beings, live in the world of desire, that you know, the kind of shaping momentum, the shaping dynamic of everything is desire. So that's what you're pointing to here. The objective realm defines what I long for. You go on, though. I'm sorry, I stopped reading in the middle of the sentence. What I long for, what I resent, elements too much in my face, so that the self's subjective responses might be symbols of the availability of reaction-provoking arisings in the objective realm. Reaction-provoking arisings in the objective realm. Conversely, the objective realm seems to respond to what the subjective self is interested in finding outside itself. Okay, I'm going to leave that. I think that speaks for itself, or at least I have nothing to say. Ron says that Bruce's comment sounded very Heideggerian, and Gibson is Heideggerians like Gibson. He wasn't a Heideggerian, but they like him. Bruce comments on, the thing about affordance, right? He says, yes, that's nice. It helps to see hand, for instance, very neatly as subject-object affordance, right? And Karin says, focusing on the sense of touching the actions of naming. That's interesting. Pen, paper, hand, and pointing back and forth seem to take place more slowly. There is a sense of wondering. Well, that's very interesting. So we didn't bring in the notion of naming, but it would be a great place to look. Because you say, well, in order to name something, it seems as though, this may not be a very sophisticated analysis, but it seems as though there has to be something there to name. There has to be a sense of something arising. And then there's the act of naming, and now the thing has been named. And so the object, you could say, in order to be an object, like a pen or paper or hand, the examples you give, Karin, in order to be an object, it already has to have been operated on by the subject, you know, because it's only a pen because the subject has identified it as a pen. So in that sense, again, you could say subject and object are really given together. Okay, well, great. I think, you know, what everybody has reported seems to me very helpful. And I'm going to suggest, I'll put this in the orientation, that this kind of be our walk around or walkabout. I didn't practice. I don't think I assigned one last week. But for this week, you know, just let yourself see as you go about your daily activity, and maybe especially in action, but also if you just, you know, the action of picking something up and handling it is another good example. What's that relationship of subject and object? Because that is a way of getting clear on what's being described here. Good. That's very helpful. So let's take a look. So I'm going to move now into the reading for the rest of the time we have available. And we'll come back to this theme, I think, but I also want to make sure we touch on some other points. A good way to connect, it seems to me, is in the second paragraph on page 412. So Rinpoche is talking about the Logos. We've talked about it enough to, I think we don't need to say too much more about it. I'm going to give one example, actually, because I just happened to be reading an article in the newspaper today that made me think about Logos, and it's just a very simple, down-to-earth example, but I liked it. It was an interview with a woman who works for Intel. So those of you who are somewhat interested in computers knows that Intel is one of the big manufacturers of computer chips. And so they're very interested in computers. And they have hired this woman. She's been there for 15 years. She's an anthropologist. And what she's trying to investigate is how the internet or how computers are changing people's way of relating to the world, which is a very interesting topic. And so in this interview, she gave the first couple of examples she gave were about time and space. And what she said was that, I actually like the space example better, so I'll just use that one. Space, she said, is changed because of the way we use it. So it goes back again to this notion of using things. And the example she gave was, when you're in an airport, if you have a computer with you, or even a cell phone, but usually a computer, and this has certainly happened to me, maybe it's happened to others of you, the space that really matters to you is space that has an electrical outlet, someplace you can plug in your computer. And so space becomes good or bad, depending on whether it has electricity or not. And I suppose that's actually true, generally. We depend so much on electricity. You know, if the electricity goes out in our house, the house becomes a kind of a hostile, unfriendly place, the space of the house. But this example really helped bring it home. And it's just an example of the Logos being shifting as a result of the use we make of it. And we start to see the world differently. So we see space differently. And the example she gave of time was just how machines are always on, and therefore they demand that we're always responding to them. And we haven't yet figured out exactly how our time works in that sense. Now, these examples are always just first-level examples. So it's not as though they really go to the heart of the TSK vision. But I do think they help sometimes. And in this case, I think it helps to think about what the nature of how the Logos manifest or what the structures, the order, the temporal order that the Logos imposes, it changes, it evolves. But here in this second paragraph on page 412, it's talking about the most basic elements of the Logos, or the order, the first level order that the Logos puts in place. So let's look at the example. So once adopted, he's talking about how all sorts of things present themselves to be adopted as a part of the Logos. Right? Once adopted, certain of these structures are identified as absolute in the sense of being presupposed in all acts of knowing. And then he gives these examples. The initial attribution of knowledge to a self. So it's exactly what we've been looking at and focusing on so far. The existence of self and world, and first level time, space, and knowledge are such self-defined absolutes, subject to investigation, but not to being challenged from within the first level order. So, I already talked about the example of first level knowledge and how, because we usually think of it as being essentially conceptual in nature, our attempt to shift our way of knowing starts off as conceptual, and therefore it's abstract, and that's the kind of barrier that we're trying to overcome right now, the obstacle that we're trying to overcome. But the other side is that the self is the one that knows, you know. The attribution of knowledge to a self. That's a real challenge, to find a way to overcome that, and that's part of what we're looking at here. And, of course, the existence of self and world, that's maybe even more basic. Now, I was thinking when if you hear that someone, a couple you know, has had a child, a baby, the first thing you always ask is it a boy or a girl? I think that's right, without special circumstances. And you could say, well, that's the most fundamental thing about being a human being, you know, is your sex. And nowadays that's a little problematic. I mean, it's become an issue in a way it didn't used to be. But it seems like that's the first basic thing that people ask. Maybe that will change in the future. But, you know, there's a deeper level that you never ask. If you say, you know, they had a baby, you don't ask, well, is the baby real? Or does the baby exist? You know, there's some things you can't question. They're just absolutely fundamental in the whole order. And the very notion of naming something, of saying baby, is to say, yes, it exists. Yes, it's real. You know, yes, it's, you know, now that it's born, it's getting older every second. All these things, these are just the fundamentals. So it's challenging to recognize that level. It's not even a question of having to question the level or to say, well, but wait, maybe, you know, maybe that we could shift the Logos in such a way that things don't necessarily exist, even though they manifest. You know, there is some truth to that. Let's, I guess, follow that out for an example, for a moment, as an example, just to see if it helps clarify things. If you're reading a novel, the novel creates its own world. You could think of that, up to a certain point anyway, as a Logos, right? Within the Logos, you can say, well, you know, the character exists, you know, Sherlock Holmes exists, or Hamlet exists, or Faust exists, but not in the way that people in the real world exist, because it's a different Logos. To exist in that Logos is a different matter, a different proposition. Michael makes a comment here about when a baby's born, you can ask more fundamental questions. Is it healthy? Does it have all its limbs and so on? Yeah, I was thinking about those examples too. You can see that in special cases you'd ask that, I think. Okay. So the Logos has these very fundamental things about it. And the other side, the aspect to see, is that if the Logos doesn't allow something, then you have to say it's not true. So a simple example of that, which is used in one of the TSK books, is going back to a novel. You know, Rinpoche writes that if you say in chapter one of a novel that the hero has blue eyes, you can't say in chapter five that the hero has brown eyes. You can, but people say, oh, that was sloppy, or, you know, they think it's not right. Maybe some experimental kinds of novels you would. That's just a simple example of how the Logos determines what's possible. The more interesting kinds of examples have to do, and Rinpoche brings this up, they have to do with things like miracles, for instance. You know? He says it's not at the bottom of 415. He says you can't have miracles in the conventional temporal order. You can't have mystical experience. Right? And then he says this is not because such possibilities are known to be false, but because the knowledge implicit in the temporal order, and the order has its own knowledge, right? The knowledge implicit in the temporal order does not know how they could be true. The Logos does not allow for it, and so cognition must deny it. So I think that's fairly clear. Anyway, I'm going to move on. Let's just look for a moment at this notion of cognition. Rinpoche uses the word in a very specific way. And I think that if you're not reading carefully, you might get a little confused in the second chapter of the reading when it starts by saying, Klaus raises another question about the baby being born. I guess we can talk about it for a moment. He says the baby is drawn to look at the face of others. Is that part of an inborn logos? Well, that's very interesting, isn't it? I suppose in a certain sense, I don't know, you'd have to start talking about, you know, what's the relationship of the knowledge that's embedded in DNA, you know, in the genes of the baby. Yeah, there are certain actions, you know, newborn children, really brand new newborn children, respond to faces, you know, they in a way that they don't respond to other objects. And I guess I've read things about how, you know, babies in the womb respond to music, and you know, they can learn certain music in the womb, and then they respond to it after they're born. So, yeah, you'd have to look at all of that, of course. Okay, I'm not going to try to say more about that. They're interesting questions. Ron says that's an evolutionary fact. It is. How it applies here, that's an interesting question, but I'm not going to try to go into it. I wanted to make this point about the Logos, about cognition. At the beginning of 414, at the beginning of the chapter, Rinpoche writes, "The knowledge inherent in the Logos is available as an object of observation or inquiry." So, given the fact that that starts the chapter, you might think that what he's saying is, well, this is what we want to understand. We want to understand how can we observe or inquire into the Logos. But that's not right. That's not actually what he's saying. I mean, he does say that. He says that's an issue. But that whole way of looking is grounded in the sense of the self that cognizes. So cognizing is one possibility for the Logos. I mean, one way of relating to the Logos is to cognize it. And of course, the word cognize is just another word for knowing, but here he's using it as a specific term. So the whole beginning discussion in this chapter about how cognition works, how cognition goes about knowing the Logos, is interesting and valuable and important, But it's really setting things up to go on to a second way of knowing, which is to know through the Logos, or to know with the knowing of the Logos. That is going really towards second-level knowledge. That's what Rinpoche is pointing towards here. And the exercise we did, I think, also points toward that. It's allowing for the possibility of a cognition that is not the cognition of the Logos, but the cognition through the Logos. And that gets talked about in this chapter. And what Rinpoche says is that if you cognize the Logos, you're really cognizing the structures that the Logos makes available. And so you miss the whole idea of the Logos. It recedes from view, is what he says here. He says what appears in its place are the structures of the prevailing order, including the first level modalities of time, space, and knowledge. And cognition itself is reduced to explanation. And there's a very interesting discussion I'm just going to mention because we're out of time. At the bottom of 416 and 417, about how sometimes first-level knowledge really can result in new, important knowledge. And the description that he gives there, I think it's fair to say that it's a description of, among other things maybe, but perhaps especially, a description of how science works. You know, he says, if you're dedicated to knowledge, if you're not really trying to satisfy the goals of the self, so we're back to this notion of love of knowledge that we've talked about in the past. If your goal is really to develop knowledge, then you can use explanations to generate theories. You can observation is self-correcting, and you get good knowledge, usable knowledge. So it's a very interesting discussion. It's one of these places where in just a paragraph Rinpoche says something really interesting about a fundamental issue, which is, in this case, how scientific knowledge works and why it's valuable and why it's effective. Okay, let me, I'm going to stop there and look at two comments here. Michael asked the question, does the Logos expand when we become able to see more knowledge? Or are we then seeing more of a Logos that was already expressing more knowledge than we were able to apprehend? It's a good question. I think basically, you know, if you structure it in terms of cognition of the Logos, you're already presupposing the first level structures of the Logos that's in effect. So that leads more toward the notion of you just kind of discover aspects of the Logos. And of course, in some sense, then the order shifts, but the fundamentals of the Logos don't shift. You might say it expands, but maybe at that point that's a little question of vocabulary. Karen asks about whether cognition, she asked about the German for that, erkennen und verstehen durch denken. I don't know, Karen. I would want to look it up in a dictionary and do some real investigation. Cognition in English usually, I don't know, it just has a kind of a technical sense to it, but that's about all I can say right now. So I can't answer that question. Okay, let us go ahead and stop there. And there's more in these chapters. I think I'll say a little more in the transition. But I think that what we investigated through that exercise and you know, your comments, which were really very rich, I think that gives us a good way to keep going forward. Okay, we will talk again, meet again next week. Goodbye.